This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
إن الإنسان في خسر إلا الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات وتواصوا بالحق وتواصوا بالصبر.
سلام أو أخر. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. By the time, surely man is lost, except those who believe and do good works, and those who exhort one another with truth, and those who exhort one another to be patient.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. The following tape includes questions that were asked of Bilal Phillips and other Muslims participating in the Saudi Cultural Information Exchange in the Qobar district of Saudi Arabia. The questions are being asked by American soldiers who participated in the Desert Shield, Desert Storm operation. The questions were asked in May 1991.
Assalamu alaikum, which is the Islamic greeting, peace be on you. And before I say anything about myself, I'd like to welcome you all here in the country and hope that your stay, you know, is beneficial, that you come out of here, you know, having gained some kind of new concepts about this part of the world and these type of people. And we hope that, you know, this would be a basis for further friendship between Americans and people from this part of the world. Myself, I'm originally from Jamaica, the West Indies. I was born there. And my parents migrated to Canada when I was quite small. I grew up in Canada. And went to college in Canada also. And back in about 1972, I accepted it. And after trying to get as much knowledge as I could about Islam in Canada, I realized it was necessary for me to come over to this part of the world to try to get to the source where one may learn Arabic, because, as I'm sure you probably heard or will hear, the basic book of revelation in Islam, known as the Quran, is in Arabic. It's been translated into English and to other languages, but whenever you find one, they have copies here, you will see that the Arabic English is there. Why? Because the revelation as it came in Arabic has been preserved. So a person, you know, in the course of translation, something of the original is lost, because it's impossible to translate from one language really to another in the full sense. So I had a desire to want to read that revelation as it was revealed and to understand the basic principles of the religion, you know, from the original sources. So I came over to, I got a full scholarship also, like Abdi Salam, and to the University of Medina. I did a course in Arabic and did my BA from there in Islamic Studies. Also, I did an MA from the University in Riyadh in Islamic Theology. I'm now presently completing a degree in Islamic Theology from the University of Wales in Britain. That's my background. I'm here on invitation of Abdi Salam to share in the activities here of trying to, you know, clarify for you all, you know, something of the culture and the thoughts of the people here, because I've been here for close to 16 years, you know, so I do have a basic understanding of, you know, what's happening. And I hope that I'll be able to share something with you this evening. And I believe Abdi Salam, I believe after that we just go into a question or answer type situation, or any questions you'd like to ask, I'll try to answer what I can. Yeah, thank you, Brother Bilal. Basically, we try to accommodate members of our audience as per your request. If you wish Jimmy Swaggart, preaching, Reverend Knight, or whatever else, whatever preacher that you're familiar with, we can try to do that. That's not our specialty, by the way, nor is that the reason why we're here. However, if you wish to ask questions and to possibly receive answers as to what Saudi Arabian society represents and the role that Islam impacts within this society, within this country, you guys might owe it to yourself to become a little more familiar with that, okay? This might be an opportunity for you guys to ask questions. Ask questions from the sources and try to obtain understanding, try to obtain some sort of consciousness. It'll be not only a disgrace, but it'll be also an embarrassment for you guys to have been members of one of the most sophisticated and comprehensive military maneuvers in U.S. history, as well as in international warfare. And you come to a country such as Saudi Arabia, and then you leave, you go back home as Dutch. Try to learn something about it. Name, rank, serial number, and where you're from.
My name is Richard Miles Murphy, Florida. And my wife, I'm from Florida. When all this started, and the Saudi Arabian people saw this mass influence of military vehicles and tanks and all these weapons of destruction, what was the locals' thoughts about that? Did they like it, or did they resent it, or were they more for it or against it?
Actually, the reactions were mixed. Many people were shocked, resentful, you know. And this is based on the history of the American military in various parts of the third world, you know, where the military has set up base in Manila, in used Bangkok for R&R, Hong Kong, you know, Singapore. You know, these places where American military presence has been, you know, have become to a large degree, I mean, for people who are particular about morals and, you know, these type of things, corruption. So they feared that this could happen to the society. And naturally, that made them to some degree resentful. There are other people who were more aware of the military implication of Saddam's entry into Kuwait, who looked at American presence here as being, you know, a saving type situation. I mean, it was something beneficial, as long as the presence, you know, was not prolonged. So you found reactions of people, you know, between the two.
Right. Questions, answers, or comments? Yeah. Name, rank, serial number, which one?
Special scholar from Fort Worth, Texas, and I have one question for you.
What do you do?
As I said before, I told the operations
question. Yes, ma'am, yeah.
My question might seem a little bit personal, but I understand that you're from Canada, from the western part of the world, and I'd like to know what are your feelings between, what do you like or dislike about the Eastern world compared to the Western world and vice versa?
I would say that from the point of view of administration, the people in this part, you know, are not that sophisticated. So it means that a lot of things that could get done in a very short space of time take a long time. You know, that's probably the most obvious difference. I mean, there are other observations that, you know, people see, you know, like in terms of driving habits, etc., and speeds and stuff and things. But what I found is that by understanding the reasons, I mean, why administration is in the state that it is, why our drivers as reckless as they are, you know, from the point of view of the society having reached a state technologically within a very short space of time, you're taking people who were riding camels yesterday and you put them into cars today. And don't be surprised if they want to do things with the cars that they did with the camels. You know, I mean, it's understandable. It's understandable. I mean, and if you look at it from that point of view, then you can appreciate it. You know, that it takes time, you know. In earlier times, people would get licenses without having really gone through qualifications. Now, they have a system where, you know, people are going through testing, and so their, you know, the quality of driving is improving. The, you know, the administration functioning is also improving. So, by understanding, one can be patient and handle these type of things. But probably for me, the most profound difference that I can really appreciate is the peace that exists in this society. In spite of the war, in spite of the war, the situation that's occurring here, I mean, within a particular space of time, there is a peace in this society that I think you will seldom find in societies around the world, I mean, especially in the West. Crime is just virtually non-existent. A person, I don't feel worried about my son and my daughter if they go out to visit friends and they come back at 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm not worried, you know, in any way in that sense, you know. My wife doesn't, you know, have any kind of fears if she goes to visit a friend, you know, late at night. There's no worries about time and personal safety. And it's just a beautiful feeling to just be able to, you know, live without the pressure and the worry of crime on the scale that it exists in the West.
What are some of the things here that you have found? I mean, you've been here for a long time. You have not just arrived last month or last week. I mean, you've been here for a number of years. You speak the language fluently. You know many people know you, and so forth and so on. Can you possibly give us some sort of insight as to what makes these people tick? Why do Saudis differ from, let's say, the Koreans, if they differ? Why do the Saudis differ from, let's say, the Lebanese, the Palestinians? What are some of the cultural norms that is inherent in this part of the society that we find so different back home in the United States, Canada, Europe, etc.?
And I would say that probably the fact that Islamic law is the law of the land, this makes a profound, you know, difference between the peoples of this area and peoples of other Arab and neighboring countries who may have similar ethnic roots and may have similar religious convictions. However, the law of Islam has not been implemented in those other countries, whereas it has been here. Because the peace that I spoke of, that safety, that sense of safety and lack of worry over crime is a direct result of the implementation of Islamic law, which I'm sure you've heard of, you know, from a point of view of it being, like in the West they like to refer to it as being medieval, you know. They chop off people's hands, you know, when they steal, and they chop off their heads when they kill, and so it's usually, this is how it's presented, and of course people tend in the West to be, you know, wow, taking off a hand, you know, chopping off a head. But it's not something which is happening like on a daily basis. It happens on occasion. But it has a deterrent factor to it that causes criminals or those who have criminal intent to harbor, you know, trying to express these intentions for fear of what, and the full weight of the law falling on them. You know, women, if a woman is raped in this country, the law is that the rapist receives the death sentence. You
you know, in America, as in the paper. Well, the death sentence, you know, he is executed, his head is chopped off. I mean, according to Islamic law, it doesn't have to be your head cut off. It could be a bullet in the back of your head, or could, you know, whatever, but you're executed quickly and relatively painlessly. But the point is that the law is very swift also. It's not a question that you're going to sit in jail for 10, 15 years and, you know, and just you have lawyers who are trying to protect your interests. And no, if you are caught with the goods, then, you know, in a very short space of time, maybe a matter of weeks or a month, the law reaches its end of its investigation and the law is applied. It is sure and it is swift. So the criminal element to a large degree is eliminated. It doesn't have an opportunity to function, as it would say in the West. You know, I read in the papers not too long ago that the reported rapes in America, you know, had crossed the 100,000 mark in America. 100,000 rapes that were reported. And we know per year. And we know that those that are not reported are going to be many more. So much so that the people who are, you know, announcing and talking about it are saying it's reached epidemic proportion. Because such crimes, you know, are treated lightly in the society. Human life is valued, individual human life is valued over the health of the society as a whole. Whereas in this society, individual human life is not given value over the whole society. If that individual human life becomes a danger to the well-being of the society as a whole, then that human life is eliminated. And that simple principle in Islamic law has produced, you know, that peace that I referred to that exists within the society, you know, and separates it from other neighboring countries that have common ethnic backgrounds and even Muslim peoples.
Can we get some questions or some comments, some observations regarding what Madam Bilal has said? Maybe we can better understand what's happening at Kipasa. Name, rank, and number,
okay. My name is Michelle Fontima from Fort Riley, Kansas. I work at ATCMC as a maintenance material officer. Anyway, I'm curious, or I was hoping that you could help me understand the role that females play here and the dress code hiding.
Well, the role of a woman in this society is primarily that of a mother. The society doesn't say that the woman has to be only a mother and she cannot be anything else but a mother. But that particular role is given precedence and encouraged, strongly encouraged. A woman is encouraged to be educated also, because they do believe that, you know, education of a woman is education of a generation, a family, a society, whereas education of a man is really education of an individual, because an educated woman will be able to provide for her children, you know, what an uneducated woman will not be able. So there is an encouragement for education. However, that education is what we could call separate but equal. There are girls' schools, girls' universities, and boys' schools and boys' universities. This existed in the West at one point in time, and then they decided that it was not necessary, not progressive, or whatever, and it was removed. Here, it is maintained. There is a separation between males and females on a general scale in the society, and the dress code also represents an aspect of that separation, in the sense that it requires that a man who is dealing with a woman deal with her on the basis of her intelligence, not on the basis of her body. You know, if you want to sell a car in America, the best way is to put, you know, we know who on top of the car, half naked. You know, you want to sell a razor blade, then you have to have a woman somehow there when the man is shaving, you know, either clutching onto his hand or, you know, something like that. I mean, the whole
way in which any product is sold in America, in the West, is sold through using the female as an object, a sexual object. This society is opposed to that fundamentally. And the woman is not a sexual object. You know, she, the role of sex is within marriage. The role of sex is within marriage. There's no sex outside of marriage. And that's why we said the person who commits rape, he's executed. A person who commits fornication is lashed, 100 lashes, publicly. A man or woman who commits adultery is stoned to death. This is the law. So this law can only function reasonably in a society where things which would invite breaking the law exist. So a woman is covered, except what is particularly required is covered except for her face and hands. She wears loose clothing which doesn't accentuate or promote her figure. And even the males are encouraged to wear loose clothing. This is why the common dress is the long flowing like robes that the men wear also. They're not allowed to wear the kind of, you know, skin tight clothing which will expose their private parts. This is also prohibited for males. So it is not just something on the females, nothing on the males. It's for the protection of the society as a whole. Because the goal of the society is a chaste society. It doesn't deny the role of sex, but it says that sex should be within a particular context, which is controlled, so that it doesn't harm the society. We don't have illegitimate children. We don't have the spread of diseases like AIDS and herpes, etc., etc. Because this happens when there is what they call promiscuity in the society, where anybody does it with anybody anyhow. So this is the goal behind it. It's not to hide the woman from the society and prevent her from playing a role within the society. No. It says, no, she has a role. She's encouraged into medicine, into teaching, into various fields, which help to develop and build the society. But at the same time, she, because of the fact that we recognize that women, I mean, I know women don't like to hear this, but we recognize, or Islam recognizes, that women are weaker than men, physically. Physically, they're weaker than men. I mean, the top high school sprinter, you know, is as fast as the top female Olympian. You know, I mean, the differences between males and females physically, generally, is a reality. And that's why, when they're talking about the 100,000 rapes in America last year, they're not talking about women raping men. This is the reality. So, the society tries to protect the weaker members of the society. Children, systems are set up to try to protect them, and also to protect women also. And this dress code is part of that system for protecting the woman as well as protecting the society. And the dress code for the men also is there to protect the society from the harm which can come from excessive promotion of the sexual aspects of the human being.
If I may ask you, what observations do you have, prejudices did you come to Saudi Arabia with before you came here, insofar as your orientation back home prior to arriving in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia? Insofar as the women issues concerned, how did you see it then, and how do you see it now, especially after my brother Salam Abu-Amina Phillips has somewhat touched upon some of the highlights or points of this women's phenomenon too?
Well, before I came out here, I was told that women were treated as second-class citizens. And I've been out in the sand, in the desert, and I just came in here in this location, so I really haven't had a chance to come in contact. I don't know. You just clarified a little.
If there's some other points that you want to get more clarity on, go ahead.
Is it true in second-class citizens, females?
Well,
You know, it depends on what you mean by a second-class citizen.
For example, walking behind a man?
No, Islam does not require a woman to walk behind a man.
No, babe.
Go ahead.
Okay, on the buses, sitting in the back.
Okay, sitting in the back of the buses. What you have to understand is when buses first were brought in the kingdom, when they first started with buses, they put the women in the front of the buses.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, in Islam, they tried to maintain the segregation between males and females, right? So they had a separate section for women in the front of the bus, and the men were behind them. But they found that, of course, when the women were put in the front, then the men all behind them, they were ogling the women. So they felt it was better to avoid this ogling to put the women in the back of the bus. So it was just for convenience sake and protection of the women. And we know in Bangkok, just recently, the country has decided to have separate buses for men and separate buses for women because the women were under constant attack. And I'm sure any woman who has to go to work in rush hour in any of the major cities where there are crowded buses, I mean, they know what they go through. So to try to protect them, you know, a separate section was given to them on the bus. And as I said, initially it was in the beginning, and then in the front of the bus, later they moved it to the back. And this was for the protection of the women. It has nothing to do with them being second class.
I heard females shouldn't go into some stores. Is that true?
No, there are no stores that I know of that females can't go into, but there are stores that males can't go into, that only females can go into. The only stores I could say that I know of directly that females are not allowed into are video stores. Okay? But there are many more stores that females can go into that males can't go into. The number you'll find, these are stores in different parts of the city that are run solely by females and selling, you know, the type of clothes that private clothes, underwear, etc. for females, and the men are not allowed to go in there.
Okay, being a female officer, okay, I'm going to ask you a question. I tell a lot of my subordinates what to do and what needs to be done. How do they or y'all take orders from females?
If a female is put in a position of authority, you know, then that authority is recognized within the society, you know. But what you find is that the institutions where females are in, generally speaking, these institutions are separate institutions. So you don't really have much of the situation where females are ordering males to do certain things. Not very much. In the medical field, you know, in a hospital where you have males and females in a closer relationship, you will find that, you know, where a female may be a specialist in a particular field, and then if she tells a male to go and do this or a male has to go and do that, you know, he just has to go and do it, like anybody else. But I'm just saying that that's not the norm. The norm in the society is that there are banks set aside for females that are run by females. Everything in it is done by females. There are male banks that the females can go into also. They're not prevented from going there. But the female banks, men are not allowed to go in. You have, as I said, the universities. You have female universities that are run from top to bottom by females.
Lieutenant, I was just wondering if I know you have other concerns. Okay, I know you have other preoccupations. I assume, correct me if I'm wrong, that you've experienced certain changes or certain scenes here in your military capacity as a military officer. I'm assuming that because this has been the feedback from many other female officers from major on down to other NCOs. Can you maybe share with us some of those experiences or concerns?
Yeah,
I'm in Kuwait, Iraq,
and I have not
been
in contact with, you know, the Iraqis,
Kuwait,
Saudi
Arabia,
until here.
And what about a runaway
federal or something? Well, not that. I was running the other day. Let me see. I was running the other day. Matter of fact, it was yesterday. And I was told that Saudi Arabians don't look at, you know,
That individual was one with criminal intent. I mean, according to the law. You know, I say because the law exists, it doesn't mean that there are no criminals. You know, if the law is being implemented, there are still people who are willing to go outside the law. And that man obviously was trying to go outside the law. You know, he has watched some video films which have come from the United States, you know, which portray the average American woman, you know, as, you know, easy. You know, you just got to pull out some money and she's, you know, ready for you. You know, this kind of, unfortunately, this is, you know, the image that America has promoted of its women through these films. And so such individuals, having seen that, have felt that, you know, if I produce some money, maybe she'll, you know, come with me. So this is as I said, this is something which is, you know, an aberration. It's not a norm. And I wouldn't want to judge the whole society by that particular experience. You know?
Well, I just thought it was sharp, you know. All I know is what people told me about here. And that was my first experience. Well, when I came forward, I, you know, there were servers that were just there.
I'm sure if you reported that individual to any of the officers or you know, they have even what they call the moral police here. And if you reported him, he'd be carted away faster than you could, you know, blink your eye. So they have the moral police which operates within the major city to prevent these type of things from occurring.
I'm trying to request Charles Richard from Chevron with Finnegan Finance.
My corporate
From Illinois, Chicago, yeah.
You like that?
Yes, far away. I'd like to know, in Saudi Arabia, are women allowed to vote? And if so, are they allowed to hold any kind of positions in government?
Well, the structure of the government is such that it has been ratified by the society as a whole. You know, it doesn't go through an electoral process. So you could say the average citizen doesn't vote. There's no voting involved. You know, what they have done instead is that each community, each area has a person who they look up to, you know, who may be equivalent to a mayor or something like this. And this person who they look up to and trust to choose somebody who would represent them, they're the people who do the choosing. You know, so it doesn't follow the democratic process as we understand it back in the West. And as such, it's not an issue of women being allowed to vote or not allowed to vote because there's no voting per se for the masses as a whole. In terms of offices or positions, you know, there are women who hold different positions within corporate structure. Within the government per se, you know, generally speaking, I would say that the males are the ones who handle the positions in government. That is the, you could say the general status of government and males, females. I'd just like to add that, you know, there's a general attitude in the society towards family structure, in that the male in the family is looked at as the head of the family, and he takes the major responsibility in terms of decision-making, etc. Not that, you know, women may not be involved in the decision-making in the family, but the final word is, like, with the male. That's the way it is on a family level. And naturally, what you find is that the society as a whole reflects that. So the governmental positions, etc., these are done by males. So I think it's a reflection of that general family pattern.
The question I have to see on family structure is how do the women go about getting married?
Okay, as you said, you know, that there is a separation in the society, girls going to girls' schools, boys going to boys' schools. So naturally, you know, a boy is not going to be interested in a girl because he saw and had an opportunity to be around a girl. What tends to happen is that if a boy reaches a marriageable age, because we're only dealing in marriage, there's no girlfriend, you know, a boyfriend, no engagement, no, it's just a question of marriage. If a man or young man reaches a marriageable age, he wants to get married, he informs his family, then his family starts to look for a suitable wife for him. That family may talk to their friends or other distant relatives, ask them, you know, do you have any daughters, or they may know, and they discuss amongst themselves. The mother especially plays a big role in this, because she knows her son, knows his likes and dislikes, and she may discuss, you know, with another mother who knows her daughter and knows her likes and dislikes. And, you know, if they think they amongst themselves that there is some compatibility there, that they would make a good match, then they will introduce the boy to the girl. They will sit down chaperones. You know, I know this again sounds like, you know, America back in the 1800s and before. But this is the principle here. The boy and girl, they need to sit down and discuss. So that is a question of them determining, you know, on a mental level, are they compatible? Not a question of, you know, being turned on and going through the whole process of et cetera, et cetera. You know, to determine, you know, start trying the goods before you buy it, type of, you know, approach. No, it maintains the chastity of the woman and the man by them sitting, discussing with a chaperone their own likes and dislikes. And of course, it's going to limit what they can talk about. You know, that way, the possibility of game is reduced, you know, where a man might, you know, run a game on a woman, you know, give her all kinds of stories, I'll do this and you're this, and, you know, play on her sympathies and, you know, get her emotionally worked up. You know, she gets blinded to really what this guy is about. So to prevent all that kind of thing, their meeting is a chaperone meeting where they get to generally understand each other. Of course, you know, one wonders, well, in that case, I mean, what happens when they get married? Well, in America, where people have full opportunity to explore sexually each other before marriage, you know, the rate of divorce is 50% plus. So obviously, this process of exploring, you know, does not improve the quality of the marriage in any way, in that sense. When you look in this society, the rate of divorce is much, much less. Because people, when they marry, they're not comparing. You know, when you've been married, when you've had so many relationships with women, and she's had so many relationships with men, when you two get together, there's a tendency for you to compare him with other people you've related with, and for him to compare you with other women he's related with. And of course, once these type of things happen, you know, then it's very easy for problems to arise, and, you know, a person to say, well, you know, I can find somebody better, you know, I like so-and-so better, or whatever. So, the people when they meet, you know, when they marry, they're having sex for the first time. So this, generally speaking, does not tend to be, you know, a basis for break-up of relationships.
He mentioned the fact that the divorce rate is relatively low here, so that takes in my mind that it does exist. However, what are the consequences of a woman getting a divorce? We might want to talk about that in relationship to the Americans. What are the consequences of the divorce, and if they do exist?
Well, in this society, divorce, the process of divorce is not a very difficult process. It's not the type of thing that happens, say, in the West, where you're going to court and lawyers arguing and fighting over how the division of the money is and all this type of thing. This doesn't exist here. The process of divorce is fairly painless. There is no alimony. No alimony in the process of divorce. However, the maintenance of children is required. You know, a man is responsible for his children, to look after those children. But because the family structures are strong, if a woman is divorced, she has family support behind her. She's not thrown out into the society now, stigmatized and on her own. She has family support. Remarriage can take place if she wishes. And, even though the divorce is rare, it's not that common as it would be, say, for example, in the West, people are not stigmatized by it, and people do remarry, after divorce, etc.
Is that the point? Okay, thank you. Even the other night I've been here, throughout the year, when we're speaking that Saudi Arabia has the most liberated females in the world. Check. Okay, my question is, I have a friend, the Queen of Sultan, and he told me he had a new wife. Saudi citizen of the Queen of Sultan. Right. The guy was telling me about the other night. Okay, for a man can have a new wife, can a woman have a new husband? Okay, that's the first part of his question, and if there's a second part, we'll get back to it, Lieutenant. If a man can have more than one wife, if he can practice the secret art of polygamy in the society, can he tell his wife also practice this not so secret art of polygamy? What's happening there? Doesn't he know?
Well, the case of a man having more than one wife is one in which he is required to look after the females, and the maximum number is four, according to law, justly and equally wherever possible. So, it's not just like a free-for-all, like anybody can have as many wives as he wants, and he can do anything he wishes. There are laws and guidelines which govern the process of marriage within, according to Islamic law, and he has to stay within these guidelines. And these guidelines protect the rights of the women and men involved. In the case of a woman having more than one husband, this is prohibited according to the law. This law is not something new from the Mosaic law. It's in tradition, prophets who had more than one wife, according to Mosaic law, women were not allowed to have more than one husband. And the primary reason, I would say, is because family structure, wherein a child knows who his father is, can only be maintained if a man has more than one wife, and it cannot be if a woman has more than one husband. I think this is one of the primary, factors which are involved. Of course, there is another factor, that of population. If we look in America, we look in Russia, the major countries, the population of women is greater than the population of men. And the allowance for polygamy is to deal with that type of circumstance. Women live longer than men. Men, generally speaking, die in the battles. So for these variety of factors, as well as even biological in terms of births, etc., the quantity of women, generally speaking, everywhere is greater than the quantity of men. So the allowance of polygamy is to help to alleviate that circumstance. Polyandry, wherein a woman has more than one husband, that would be defeating this principle of dealing with the, you know, demographics of the society, or the breakdown of men and women in society.
Women here in the society are supposed to be some of the most liberated women on the face of this earth, second to none, the Muslim woman. Why is it that she is not only in total obscurity in her dress, but also in her behavior? Why is it that G.I. Joe and G.I. Jane cannot see them? I mean, is she so equal? Is she so wicked? What does she have to lose? Why can't she not come here, okay, and talk to us directly as to what her feelings on various subject matters are? Lieutenant Creasy, would you like to know?
Well, I would say that it is more a question of organization than a question of, you know, women not being allowed to be here. You know, generally speaking, it's very easy to arrange for women to come and talk to a group of women. You know, because of this same separation, maybe you didn't come in at the time when we were discussing the issue of separation of sexes within the society. These type of arrangements have taken place. Groups of female soldiers have been taken into homes and into halls where they've sat and discussed with local women, you know, about the situation here and the situation for women. But generally speaking, women are not put in a situation where they are surrounded by a large, you know, body of males. You know, this is just a norm in this society. And it's in Islam, as I said before, you know, encourages that women deal with women, you know, and men deal basically with men. If you go back to America, because of the fact that the American society is an open society, it would be quite easy for you to meet, if you went to an Islamic center, a Muslim woman and speak to her and ask her what does she think about Islam and so on. So it would be much easier there in America. And of course, English is their language. The average Muslim woman here doesn't speak English. You know, I mean, it would be much easier there in America than it would be here. So let me just add also that the when we're talking about liberation doesn't mean that anybody can do anything. You know, this is the point, you know. Liberation, because once you're talking about that kind of liberation, you're talking about anarchy, really, you know, chaos in society. I mean, freedom has its bounds. It has its bounds. And the man here is not free to go anywhere he wishes to go. There are places which are out of bounds to him. You know, and any society, for it to develop in a healthy fashion has to have certain checks and balances, guidelines to protect the society as a whole, where there will be places which are out of bounds.
I'm missing something here. We're not chaotic and out of control. Is that what you're saying? That because we allow the female to get into dialogue and we're out of control and we have no chaotic society?
No, I'm not saying that. You know, I'm just saying that in a country where, as was reported, I mentioned earlier, as was reported in the newspapers recently, the number of reported rapes was greater than 100,000 last year in America. You see, this liberated society has at the same time produced an epidemic of rape, where the woman is under attack. The majority of the women in the society, wherever they interact, whether it's on the job or it's going in the buses or in the army, they did a study of women in the army. And the majority of them were saying they were being attacked.
U.S. Army.
So, if we don't have some checks and bounds, then we end up with a situation like that. It's harmful.
There are approximately over 250 million Americans. That is even less than 10%, less than 5% of what you're talking of. Also, there are females who are presidents of universities, there are females who in the police department, there is a female general. Because of this situation, you take a female, all of them, because every country has some bad criminals, and you take those. But because less than a percentage, a minute portion of our population does make a few mistakes, you take all our females and put them in the house and don't let them come out and don't give them a choice to make decisions where how they want to run their lives and operate in our society. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I would say that the Islamic society or this society does not keep the women in their homes and deny them any function within the society. It doesn't do that, we're not saying that extreme. We're just saying that by segregation of sexes in the society as a whole, this protects the women from the abuses that tend to come from societies where there is no segregation, no checks and bounds for the protection of the society and protection of the women. This is what I'm saying. And when we talk about 100,000 reported rapes, we're not talking about the five or six times that number which are unreported. I mean, when the people who talked about this and reported these figures, they were crying about it. They were saying this has reached epidemic proportions in the society. I mean, this is not something that we can take lightly and say, well, it's only 2%. No, it is something devastating. And what we're saying is that how do you deal with that? We're not saying that you deal with that by locking the women in the home. No. We're saying that the role of the women in the society and the men in the society, has to come under some control for the benefit of the society as a whole. And in this society here, where women are given the opportunity for education, there are girls' schools, many, many girls' schools, there are women's universities, there are a number of them. There are businesses which are run totally by women. There are banks which are run totally by women. There are shops run totally by women. You have women play a major role within the society. But it is not, on a mixed, free-for-all type basis. And they have found that as a result of that, this helps to protect the society from the kind of corruption which can occur. And women tend to be the ones who suffer the most in these circumstances.
Yeah, before we go on the sentence, I just want to make a comment here, guys. Guys, what we're saying here and what we're trying to say here is number one, we are not here to preach to you guys, nor are we here to be preached to. If you want the women to burn their bras out in public, to burn their panties, that's all fine and good. If you want to expose your women, that is fine for you. But within the Islamic concept, okay, of that which is considered moral and that which is considered right and decent, it is unacceptable and it will not be tolerated. This is the Islamic perspective and position on that. Okay? So this is all we want to do, is just communicate. If you want to expose your women, put them on bazooka, a chewing gum, and sell her, you know, her numbers, I mean, 32, 38, that's all fine and good. Do it. Okay? But I prefer to have my women, nobody's bazooka, you know, commercial, Kellogg's, cornflakes, carton, and so forth and so on. You understand? This is what it's all about, okay? We're not here to preach or to be preached to. We're just trying to interchange information. You want to expose your women, your daughters, your wives, your female folks, that's all fine and good. But here, in the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, it will not be tolerated. It never has been, it is not now, and it will, inshallah, will never be. The Islamic position on that is very clear. Okay, so, por favor, okay, please try to understand this, understand that, and try to respect us for that. Okay, because we can go on and on and on. Okay, and, you know, if that's what you wish, well, fine and good. Expose yourself, show it off, give her, you know, to the highest bidder, auction her off. I mean, that's cool. Sell her, I mean, you know, deep throat action, that's fine. But for us, our women, we don't play that, okay? Questions, observations, or comments? Yeah. Name I should have waited from.
I'm John Morris, I'm from Roseville, Dominica. Pertaining to the question about marriage, if a man wishes to get married a second time, or he wishes to take a wife a second time, does his family go through the same procedure? And if so, when he gets ready for his second wife, or third or fourth, is it because he has, you know, use the other one as much as he wanted to, or he, not proud of her, but bored with her? Is that the perception that the gentleman, I guess one of the other ladies can answer, is that the general idea? Because I know it's not through the process you were talking about, the demographics of the, you know, society, that's why they take a second wife. It's good to have, but is that the reasoning they have, they're tired of the wife, or they're bored with the wife, but they're going to still keep her as a wife and keep the second wife?
People may do it for a variety of reasons. You know, Islam does not seek, or the law does not seek to determine the intent of the person, because that's something between him and God. You know, what his intent is. If the intent is not an acceptable intent, then he has to answer as a sinner before God. If his intent is acceptable, then he is blessed by what he is doing. So, at the time when he decides he wants to have a second wife, he is allowed to do so if he is capable of maintaining that wife. The society will not allow him if he is not. There are checks that are there to prevent him from doing so merely because he wishes to do so and he doesn't have the means to do so. And if he is going to, in this society, he's going to choose a second wife, he doesn't just, you know, go around the society and find a wife and a second person and marry her. It's done. No. Again, the family is going to come into play because he will have to go through the parents of that girl. So the parents will look into his situation. Is he capable of maintaining a family? And also, she will have to accept it. It's not just a question that, you know, the marriage is decided for her and she must marry that person. So the people who are involved understand what is involved in the second marriage.